like to call this meeting of the House Transportation Committee to order. It is currently 1:02 p.m. on Thursday, January 22nd, and we are in the Barnes Room 124 in the Alaska State Capitol. Members present today are Representative St. Clair, welcome. Representative Nelson, also welcome. Two new members today. Representative Stutes, Representative Mina, Representative McCabe, right under the wire, Co-Chair Eichheit, and myself, Co-Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business, and please take this time to silence your cell phones during our meeting. Before we begin, I'd like to thank Jordan Nicholson from House Records, Susan Quigley from the Juno LIO, and her counterpart, who's brand new today, Jude Augustine. Welcome. Our committee aide is my staff, Griffin Sukeo, and Meredith Trainer from my co-chair's office. Thank you for being here today. On today's agenda, we are hearing a presentation from the Department of Transportation on pedestrian safety and fatalities. We will be having before us Pam Golden, our statewide traffic engineer, Alex Reed, our central region design, and Shannon McCarthy, our communications director. Welcome to the House Transportation Committee. Thank you so much for being here today. And please remember to state your names for the record before we begin. Come on up to join us. And during this presentation today, while they're coming up, if members would like to ask a question, just feel free. We can take questions while the presentation is ongoing.
It's my new special seat right across from Louise. And
it's your lefty seat. Not
this
your
is,
special
I feel
one
like
here.
I'm being punished here.
It's your lucky one, sir.
You're moving on up in the table.
I'm the referee. Yeah, I'd rather be down there.
Makes it much easier for me to shoot spit wads that way instead of that way.
We can also revisit the seating chart before our next one.
You know me. I don't care. I can make trouble from any seat.
Right. So thank you so much for being here again, and take it away.
For the record, and to the chairman and chairs and committee members, thank you so much for asking us to come back again. It's going to be, I think, a good touch base from our presentation last year. And my name is Shannon McCarthy, and I'm the communication director for Alaska DOT. And just to kick us off before I turn this over to Pam Golden, the traffic and safety engineer, I just wanted to touch base on a couple of quick things. I'm sure that the committee has noticed that we did reissue an updated 2026 HSIP plan. That was done in cooperation and partnership with the municipality of Anchorage, where we really got together and we really focused on what we can deliver to Anchorage in the short term and how we can work together as partners to ensure that that gets delivered this year. We are employing a technique called advanced construct that will allow us to capture next year's dollars for projects that we can deliver now or can obligate this year. We're excited about this. We haven't used advanced construct in HSAP for a number of years, but I think it's going to be a great tool among some other things that Alex will talk about later. We are going to continue conducting those technical reviews that will enable us to understand those lane reductions and how they're going to impact the network of roads given the number of projects that were that are underway. And then, of course, I just wanted to point out that we were able to take a look at the available projects, update some estimates, and then add some other state-funded dollars so that we have restored the Anchorage funding to around $30 million for 2026.
Really briefly, if we could just have our presenters make sure to speak into the mic as much as possible.
My apologies.
Thank you. Do we have any questions on slide two, Representative St. Clair?
Through the chair, the updated 2026 Anchorage funding of $30 million, where did that come from?
Through the chair, Representative St. Clair, that is Federal Highway Administration funding through the Highway Safety Improvement Program.
Follow up? So you already had access to that. That's not new money, or is it a match, or?
Through the chair, Representative St. Clair, it is not new money, but we are using advanced construct, so that would tap into FY27.
I got it. Thank you.
Representative Mina?
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick, and thank you for presenting to the committee. I just have a few questions. So first, can you clarify your coordination with the municipality? Was this just with the update to the HSIP, or how is your coordination with the municipality on your current on these projects?
So through the chair, Representative Mina, I would say that we do coordinate with the municipality, of course, through AMATS and through Vision Zero Task Force, and you'll be hearing a lot about that Vision Zero Task Force in this presentation today. But in terms of the update to the 2026 HSIP program, we definitely met with the mayor and her staff to examine what we could do and how we could deliver the program faster.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. Through the co-chair, I wanted to know about the technical review for the lane drops. I have a lot of community members and constituents who are concerned about dropping the lane drops. What is your timeline for those technical reviews?
So through the chair, Representative Mina, we're really fortunate in that that analysis is coming pretty quickly, and there'll be one project that is actually in the new updated plan that we were able to complete the lane analysis. I'm sorry, the traffic analysis, A Street, and that one is moving forward. That where we initially had left that off on the 2026 plan, that particular project is being move forward into 2026 using advanced construct, for example. And then Ms. Golden can address the lane reduction versus road diet discussion that we're having internally as well.
For the record, Pam Golden, if we're ready to advance to the next slide, and I'm not saying that we have to, it's actually about this topic.
Do we have any other questions on slide 2? Yeah. Co-Chair Eichheit.
Yeah. Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Yeah, just Representative St. Clair just brought up this advanced construct. Is that a short for advanced construction? Am I reading that right? And I guess, well, you nodded your head, so I don't want that to be my question. Can you explain what that is? Because I heard what you said before, but just can you flesh it out a little bit more? Because it sounds interesting, I guess. It sounds different.
Yes, Chairman Eichheit and Chairman Carrick. So advanced construct is a tool that we can use. It's a financial tool, and we can, as long as the project is ready to move forward in different phases, we can use advanced construct. And it is actually called advanced construct and not advanced construction, because we might be moving forward, for example, a design phase. But it is a tool that is allowed by Federal Highway Administration, and it gives us a lot of flexibility. The HSIP program is actually very flexible in itself, that we can move a project in during the same year without having to do a STIP amendment. But advanced construct allows us to that flexibility within the regular program. As long as a project is listed in the STIP, for example, we could move it up by a year. And HSIP allows us a lot of flexibility as well, and advanced construct can also be used in that program.
Follow-up? So I think I understand it. So to clarify, though, does it mean that a project that's being funded as a advanced construct, is it a funded project? I mean, is that money there, and it's not like a down payment that the repo man might come later? I mean, is it a funded project, and it has funds to completion?
Chair Eichheit, it is considered a funded project. It is a bit like putting your project on a credit card, in that we do have to make regular payments on our advanced construct balance, and that can be done either in a given year, but we do plan for that also and recognize that in the STIP as well. We have to account for that.
Follow up.
All
right. So if there's a change in the administration and an incoming governor doesn't like this project, can they cancel it somehow?
Chairman Eichheit, I'm probably over my skis a little bit when it comes to this. Federal Highway Administration funded our federal aid
program. When we put a project in a STIP and put federal dollars to it, we are making a commitment to follow through on the project. Canceling a project would take significant agreement with across the department and with Federal Highway Administration. And even then, we might owe that money back to Federal Highway Administration.
Thank you.
Any other questions on slide two? Seeing none, we can go ahead and advance.
Okay, again, for the record, Pam Golden. So the whole concept of road diets, lane drops, the chief engineer directive, we know that this has caused quite a little concern, and we understand that. So to clarify what we're calling a lane drop versus a road diet is a proven safety countermeasure Federal Highways has studied extensively. It's generally taking a four-lane road to a three-lane road, so one lane in each direction, a center two-way left turn lane. So a four-lane road, two lanes in each direction, is the standard, well-studied, well-documented, proven countermeasure. Then that lane space can be reallocated for other uses, whether it's vulnerable road users, snow storage, whatever that might be. So for clarity, to differentiate, Anchorage is full of a lot of one-way streets. We do not have a proven countermeasure for taking a lane away on a one-way road. There is one study that's out there. One study in and of itself is not enough to call something proven, and it is in downtown Manhattan. So just pointing out, Anchorage is quite urban, but maybe not as urban as downtown Manhattan. So you know, that's our distinguishing. That's how we're clarifying when we talk about them. My apologies, there's actually one missing from this. Northern Lights should be on this list as well. So there are actually, as we met with our Vision Zero team, you know, internally, and we started talking about four HSIP projects, which would be Northern Lights, Mountain View, Ingrid Gamble, which I understand is two roads, but it's one project, and A Street. We realized that was just the tip of the iceberg as we started talking about all of the different roads that taking a lane away was being proposed in Anchorage. So, you know, through the Vision Zero team, there was discussion about we need some sort of system-wide analysis. At what point do we break the system? Like, if we start taking capacity away on multiple roads, we don't want to. We want to ensure we're not pushing the problem somewhere else, for one. Are we pushing cars into new neighborhoods? You know, as we start looking at... you know, are some of these on top of each other, you know, relatively speaking, making sure that we just aren't pushing a problem somewhere else, and knowing that we're stepping through this carefully to make sure that we end up with a safe and efficient network for all users. So the other things to consider is, you know, impacts to emergency response, impacts to freight. You know, all these different things that come in. So the real goal with why that chief engineer directive then came out, why we're working with AMATS on this system-wide analysis, is to make sure the network as a whole remains safe and works for everyone to still get around and through Anchorage.
I have Representative Mina and then Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the co-chair, could you clarify what is the difference between a road diet and a lane drop? Because I feel like, you know, a lot of people use them interchangeably.
Through the co-chair, Rep. Mina. So we're considering a road diet to be a two-way road currently with at least four lanes. And that's only because of that proven safety countermeasure and making sure that when we're out having discussions with folks that they're not relying on saying that this is going to have a proven crash reduction. We want to make sure that we're differentiating that what we're doing with potentially taking a lane away on a one-way road, we don't actually know the outcome. There are elements of reducing a lane or a lane drop, as we're calling it, that are true to both. The distance a pedestrian would have to, you know, cross active moving traffic, yeah, that's a shorter distance. One of the many benefits of a road diet is the introduction of that two-way center turn lane, and that's where we see a lot of turning traffic crash reduction. So they're just, there are elements of a lane drop that are also elements of a road diet, but we just want to make sure that we're not giving false promise.
Okay. And then follow up. Thank you. Just to follow up through the co-chair, you also said that there isn't an example of doing a lane drop for a one-way but last summer, two summers ago, there was the pilot in downtown Anchorage on 6th Avenue where they had the protected bike lane. Wouldn't that be a lane drop or an example of doing that in Anchorage?
Through the co-chair, Representative Mina, yes, that isn't a pilot project that did include a lane drop element. I'm sorry if I was unclear. What we don't have is that depth of study nationally. So one summer's worth of crash data is cool. It's not enough. We still, as much as we are here to say, you know, any crash is a bad thing, you know, a fatal or serious injury crash, we don't want those to happen. We had a good experience with the pilot bike lane, but it is just a small piece of a body of knowledge to come with something that we can go out and solidly say to the public, this is what we expect.
I have Representative McCabe next.
Thanks. This is a little bit weird to me because for years Anchorage has struggled with east-west traffic, just capacity. I used to live on the west side. I've lived on the east side. I've tried to get across town all the time, and it's always been, during peak traffic, it's always been an issue. There's just not enough east-west arteries, and now it seems like you're taking that away. So I guess my question is, have we considered maybe almost like the zipper thing you had out on the highway? So in the morning commute, you get two lanes going one way and only one coming out. And in the evening commute, you move the barriers or whatever, and you go the other way so you can facilitate the commute. So it just seems to me like we are going to restrict traffic and create more gridlock. And I'm wondering if that's really, if there's any studies. Are we doing this just for safety? Sometimes I wonder if moving cars faster isn't safer, and I don't know.
Through the co-chair, Representative McCabe, you're describing a reversible lane, and I lived in Atlanta, Georgia, and they had those. It is a technique that is out there. So that particular example, but this is, your point is exactly one of the concerns we had about making sure that if this is done, there's 13 on the slide, but we know there's 14. My apology. There are more being proposed, and this is why that Vision Zero team kind of sat there. This is why AMATS is doing a system analysis to see what all of this combined looks like.
So follow up. So one other thing that I would hope we could explore is, you know, I've traveled to many, many different foreign cities, and they restrict pedestrians by putting a barrier up on the curb and make the pedestrians go. They either got to leap the cable barrier or whatever fence they put up, or they go down to the stoplight. So it seems to me that a good chunk of our pedestrian deaths in Anchorage have been caused by people jaywalking, just crossing the street willy-nilly, not even with a light. And I just wonder if maybe if we want to keep traffic moving and yet we want to be safe and keep pedestrian deaths down, then maybe we ought to stop the jaywalking however we can. The Anchorage Assembly passing a law would be helpful, but barring that, maybe DOT could just put up barriers or fences or whatever we want to call them. I know it's probably not really great during snow season, but it's just an idea. I don't know.
Through the co-chair, Representative McCabe, one of the projects my colleague Alex will be talking about later in this presentation is pedestrian fencing on Fifth Avenue near Merrill Field. So that it is a technique that has been employed in Anchorage. It is something that is on the table. And, you know, every time we look at a project, we're trying to figure out what that best countermeasure could be.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So I'm going back to Representative Mina's question, and I listened carefully, but I'm still confused as to what the difference is. I can see the diagram of a road diet, but I'm lost as to what the difference between that. Can you simplify it just a little bit for people like me?
through the co-chair, Representative Stutes, absolutely. And we struggle ourselves to always say it right. One lane, one-way road versus two-way road. So a lane drop is what we're calling this sort of technique of removing a lane on a one-way road, we're referring to that as a lane drop to keep it clear in our own minds, versus that road diet, which if you want to Google road diets, you're going to come up with that body of knowledge on that four-lane to three-lane reduction as a proven countermeasure.
Follow up. So it was a one-way road to begin with. You're just reducing a lane?
Through the co-chair, Representative Stutes, yes.
Thank you.
And I put myself in the queue, but I just had a... you mentioned that Northern Lights is not listed on this slide, but is part of the road diet and lane drop has been re-added back.
To the co-chair, it is one of those that we are waiting on the analysis to complete. So it was not officially added back in. We moved it to 27 along with Ingram and Gamble for purposes of making sure it was clear. We don't intend to, that these aren't canceled projects. And we understand that was some confusion with how at least our internal way of referring to things was seen from the outside. A project that wasn't funded in 26 looked like it just disappeared. So for at least this update of the funding plan, we've pushed those at 27. On our side, it's not a big deal to move a project from 27 to 26 if things are ready and funding is available. The challenge is the coordination with the MPO. Their transportation improvement program process is a little bit more convoluted, I guess, for lack of a better word. And so making sure that those align will be something we'll have to work through with the MPO. If they become ready to advance faster than getting to 27.
And just as a quick follow-up, so this list in front of us is projects that are scheduled for FY27?
To the co-chair, this is a sampling of projects beyond HSIP. I'm only familiar with the delivery schedules on Mountain View is one of them. That is a city road. So we they're doing, and it actually is a road diet. It is a two-way road. And then the other ones were Inger Gamble, A Street, which A Street is moving forward to start design in 26. And now I forgot which the last one was.
For the record, Shannon McCarthy, this was actually just to illustrate the number of road diet and lane drops that have been proposed within the last 12 to 18 months.
And I have not looked yet. I super apologize. Do we have a slide later that shows the full scope of projects that were included with AMATS and then what has been essentially, what is going forward? So are we going to see that later?
For the record, to the chair, Pam Golden, to the co-chair. We have some of that information. The HSIP funding plan, which is available on our website, does have, you can get that off of our dot.alaska.gov/be-safe as one of our action plans. So it is available. We don't have a lot of detail on that in this presentation.
I have a couple of folks in the queue, Co-Chair Eichheit, then Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. I have two questions, but before I get to the questions, I did want to note that I had a meeting with Ms. Golden and Ms. McCarthy and Mr. Mills to explain some of the changes, and was super helpful. So I just want to say I really appreciate that, and I invite any members, as you see things, either before a meeting or afterwards, DOT staff has been great. So thank you. The first question is about lane drops. And I understand what lane drops are. I understand the chief engineer's directive and the systems approach and, you know, avoiding unintended consequences. And those are things that make a lot of sense to me. The question I have is, so we have we're analyzing lane drops now. We're going to analyze their impacts on traffic, local traffic movement through neighborhoods. How long would that process take? Because I understand there's not a lot of studies. And I think for a range, not a guaranteed time certain, but people want to know, how long does this take? When will the impact of lane drops be able to be a evaluation tool for pedestrian safety? So a range with 90% certainty, please.
To the co-chair, Pam Golden, in case I wasn't the current last one on the record. Ingrid Gamble, we are waiting on our traffic analysis. We have a draft. We've got some comments we're working through with regional staff to get back to the consultants on. The AMAT study, which is the more system-wide one, I apologize. I do not have the time frame on that. Last I heard, they had a consultant on board. So I don't know. I can be sure to ask at our next Vision Zero meeting, and we can get that answer to the committee. As we discussed, getting that body of knowledge, we are going to be that body of knowledge. If we go forward with these projects in Anchorage, which we may go forward with all of them, we may go forward with a handful of them, we don't know until that system analysis is complete. But once we have the post-construction data, which we look at things 3 years post-construction, we're in an incredible place to be that report that ends up in that clearinghouse that, has that research study that says, hey, you should go do this in your community too, because we found, this crash reduction in serious crashes, fatal crashes, whatever it might be. It makes my inner nerd kind of excited that we could be that leader that gets this out there for other communities to follow. We're taking a leap of faith at this point, to a certain extent to go forward, and knowing that there are some elements that are common between that lane drop concept and the road diet concept. But then, at what point is there a proven safety countermeasure for this? It's probably 5-7 years out. That doesn't mean we have to wait to go forward. It just means we have to be careful.
So before I get to my second question, my understanding is we do have to wait because we have to go through the policy analysis, unless I'm just misunderstanding. But I did hear 5 to 7 years, and that's...
To the co-chair.
Please.
5 to 7 years until perhaps there's a proven safety countermeasure out there for the rest of the world to use. The analyses are going on right now. So Northern Lights is being done through the work that's already being done on the companion projects through AMATS, that this would just sort of complement as an HSIP piece to those projects. Ingrid Gamble, we are looking at right now. The missing link to us going forward is we can know what's happening, in a vacuum on that road. It's that system analysis piece that joins with that gives, everyone the confidence that this is the right path forward. There are other countermeasures we could possibly consider for pedestrian safety, for vulnerable road user safety as well. So, it's not one, if one thing doesn't go forward, there are other options out there to reduce vulnerable road user crashes. We just, for our own level of confidence, need to know the road in itself as a vacuum has got the capacity. Everything looks great. We're not delaying emergency services, all of those things that are in the chief engineer directive. And then that system analysis, which I cannot imagine is, too far down the road if they've got a contract underway. And, there's always the things that take time. But, within the fiscal year, I expect that we'll know, what should go forward, not just with the HSIP projects, but with the whole list of 14.
Thank you. The second question, if I may,
follow-up.
I heard within the fiscal year. So that's what I was just – thank you for that detailed response, but I was just looking for the short answer. And then just on the safety thing, because I also use those east-west arteries in Anchorage, my colleague asked the question, does speeding traffic up, does that improve safety? I mean, it's a fair question, and I just, so I'm just posing, does that, or is there a reverse correlation to slowing traffic down, increase pedestrian safety? What does the science say?
To the co-chair. So it's tricky. There's not a good answer to that. A high speed access controlled facility is safe.
Access controlled.
Right? But crashes that occur at high speeds have higher severity results. So there's so many factors that play in. How many driveways are there? What are the origins and destinations for cars, for pedestrians, for bicyclists, for transit? It's not an easy answer.
Thank you.
I have Representative Mina.
Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the co-chair, I should have asked this earlier related to the technical review, but you brought up having to have this be improved by AMATS for the study related to the lane drops. So I understand the timeline. What is the process for sharing that information with AMATS, with the public? Is there going to be a role for public comment before DOT has a final decision on what they're going to do?
Sorry, I'll jump in. Okay. I think through the chair, Representative Mina, this is actually kind of complicated, and we have a slide to address this a little bit later, but HSIP is a really different kind of program in that it's data-driven, it's typically done within the right-of-way, and there is, by the time we get to the public, the solution has been identified, and we're starting down that process. So there are fewer opportunities for the public to weigh in. However, we recognize how important public, conversation and feedback are to the department. So we do plan to go out to the public and ensure that we're presenting the project, asking for feedback in terms of, the viability of the project, any things that we have missed. But we really are after that project that is a proven safety countermeasure that we know we can get results with, and oftentimes it will be an interim solution. And we recognize that a larger project may be the final solution as well. So we can be having those conversations with the public as well.
Follow up.
Yeah. Thank you, Coach Carrick. Just one more follow up, kind of a different question, but I was thinking about how, in the wintertime, when we get a lot of snow, we have natural road diets because we're plowing all the snow onto the side and we're losing a lane. Has DOT ever thought about studying the impacts on our traffic network from those road diets in the winter?
Through the co-chair, Representative Mina, and for the record, Pam Golden. It's, again, one of those, it's complicated. We have more traffic on the roads in the summer. We have less traffic on the roads in the winter. So many variables at play. These are all things, as we sit there, we kind of try to amortize, maybe that's not the right word, our traffic so that we're making sure we're accounting for these variations in seasonal traffic. To your earlier question, I don't know the timeline on when AMATS will be complete, but they do have all their own processes that they go through for when they do a study. And I imagine there's a public process on their side for that study. And so these are great things for me to make sure I'm letting the AMATS folks know are of interest.
Thank you.
I think we made it through the queue of questions. Maybe we could have the committee hold questions for a couple of slides just so we can get through a little bit more of the presentation.
Thank you. Okay. So, going back to what was in that updated spending plan, there are a suite of projects. We refer to them as the sister projects. So if we refer to it, that's what we're talking about on Inger Gamble. Alex will cover those more in detail later, but sort of what those projects entail. There's also $6 million in projects on Tudor Road. One is the channelization project between Baxter and Patterson, and then there's a design start. This is one of those projects that came back into the funding plan to start VRU improvements projects at Wright Street and Dale Street on Tudor Road. I believe that one also pairs up with another project, but he doesn't know. I was looking. it does. Yes, it does. A Street, as we mentioned, A Street was one of the lane drop projects. A Street also has other elements in it, including a new traffic signal at 16th Avenue, a pathway on the west side of A Street to connect 14th Avenue down to the Chester Creek Trail, where there's not a facility right now. And then the 5th Avenue project, which we'll also cover in a little bit more detail later, for that pedestrian improvements of safety fencing type solution up north of Merrillfield. Sorry, we're holding questions. Just a quick recap of what HSIP is. It's 29 types of projects. It's a federally mandated program. Every state has an HSIP program. It does cover infrastructure, which is what people most commonly think of, but it does allow us to do audits, collect data, implement connected vehicle technologies and do all kinds of safety planning, whether it's our strategic highway safety plan, a local road safety plan, that sort of that multi-departmental, multi-faceted sort of safety planning that we do with others to figure out how we can make our safe system out there. We are, I believe, the only program that requires us to analyze how well we're doing cost-benefit wise. Every crash has a cost that the federal government assigns, and so it's not us saying what a human life is valued at, but there are these numbers out there. Our average is 5.96 to 1. In my quick Google search, the normal is 4 to 6 across the board, seems to be about the where folks come in at. So at almost 6 to 1, we're doing very well. We're pretty proud of that. And then we are a small piece of the overall budget. We're 5 to 6% of the entire DOT highway budget. So it's a small program, and so you do see all of our projects have safety elements, but you will see if the projects get too big, we have to push them out of the HSIP program, or we don't even consider them for the HSIP program, and we look for the larger funding pots to make sure that those can get what they need. We talked about these a little bit last year, but again, these proven safety countermeasures. When we start looking at a project, we look for these proven countermeasures because that's where we can go out with this body of knowledge that says we know this is going to do good. So we dive into crashes, we read crash narratives, sometimes we follow up with law enforcement if something is unclear that we want to make sure that we understood correctly. We evaluate which of these countermeasures might work. We evaluate them in the context of the location. There are countermeasures that work in warm climates that really aren't going to work so well for us. We look at, is this something our maintenance crews can maintain? We look into existing planning documents, whether a local road safety plan, a MPO's plan, coordinating with communities to see if there are things that are already in their plans that we can advance. All right, we'll keep going. Once we've sort of come up with what we want to do, the regions prepare their nominations, which they describe the problem, the countermeasure. We do all that benefit cost prediction analysis, work with the rest of our engineering staff on estimating how much it's going to cost, how long it's going to take. Statewide does, in the past few years, we do projects that are of statewide importance, whether it's trying a new technology or, something that just applies across the state, like our road safety audit project. So it's just being managed out of one location, but being performed in multiple regions. At my level, my job is to make sure that what is proposed is eligible for HSIP spending under the rules under Section 148, so that we're, anything that gets put forward, we know is not going to get questioned later for was this actually eligible based on the funding. And then I present that information to the commissioner's office to then, what goes forward for funding. We do have our prioritization for funding is spelled out in our handbook. But again, it's what can we get on the street? Like, if something that's ready to go right now, it's how good of a project is it based on benefit cost ratio, predicted benefit cost ratio. And then we do have to do some massaging of fund management to make sure we have a robust program going forward so that there's always something in the pipeline being developed. So we don't want to get to the point where everything is built and we don't have anything get ready to be built the next year. Again, just real quick recap, project development and delivery, once an HSIP project is there, it's really no different than another project. We've got to get them into the Transportation Improvement Program in our MPOs now. So there's that coordination. And then we do our normal design and construction process with public involvement. I mentioned this last year, but as a reminder, if the scope of a project needs to change, we do have a way to walk through that. So if we just randomly, if we said we were going to build a roundabout and we really need to build a traffic signal, we have a process that we can step through that sort of a change. So worrying about scope being locked in does not have to be a worry. And then once the project is constructed and we have the 3 years post-crash data, we see how we did. and we do great so far.
For the record, Shannon McCarthy, Alaska DOT. We've covered this a little bit through Representative Zmina. Excellent question. HSAP projects can be among our most controversial. And the reason why is that because we're so focused on maximizing life saves and reducing serious injuries, we are looking at oftentimes interim solutions, projects that are within the right-of-way and that may not have an aesthetic that we've considered for community purposes. We are looking at low-cost solutions and oftentimes are not, unfortunately, able to entertain some betterments that the community has been interested in or would like to be included. And it also might change, these projects may change the way a person uses the infrastructure. So we've talked about a little bit about the channelization of vehicles. So we're basically telling vehicles you can't turn left everywhere. You've got to pick your spots. The same thing goes with safety fencing for pedestrians. We're trying to get people to cross at safer locations or locations where their drivers are or expecting them to cross, such as signalized intersections or even unsignalized intersections. And of course, infrastructure like a roundabout, it kind of forces a driver to take a right in order to take the left. Making people behave a little bit differently, and that sometimes is a big change and not always welcome. And as I mentioned to Representative Mina earlier, that we oftentimes are coming to the public once the solution has been identified. And we do try very hard to ensure that we're engaging with community councils or local community groups, making sure that we're providing those opportunities for people to be aware, ask questions, and if we can make tweaks, we'd like to do that. But these projects can be controversial.
I was going to say I have a question here. Maybe I'll go first and then have my co-chair go. So I am a little bit interested, I guess, in the safety fencing for pedestrians. Can you talk a little bit about what that looks like? Like, what's an example of a safety fencing?
Yes, Chairman Carrick. So safety fencing could be a wide variety of things. In Fairbanks, they have jersey barriers and chain link fencing. Down in Anchorage, it was, over in Minnesota, it was some metal, metal sheeting that's woven. They typically have to be crashworthy, so we are limited in terms of the type of look that we can have, but there are some options. And we can do some things in terms of aesthetics, and we certainly have indicated to the community that we, for the Anchorage area, that we'd like to make sure that we're touching base with them about the aesthetics of any fencing that project that we have.
And just as a follow-up, I grew up in Anchorage. I'm really familiar with the Minnesota area you're talking about there, and it seems like there's sometimes just disregard of those barriers and people trying to jump over them and just trying to cross anyway. So can you talk a little bit about the efficacy of the safety fencing and also community input on some of those projects in Anchorage? And have they been supported by the public in general? Are folks generally fairly neutral? What do those two components look like?
Yeah. Chairman Carrick, I'd actually like Pam to answer about the efficacy because we were talking about that earlier today. Oh, or Alex, pardon me.
For the record, Alex Reed with Central Region Design. I'm a group chief in Anchorage for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Through the chair, studies have shown about an 86% reduction in crashes with pedestrians that for mid-block crossings. And then, do you want to answer about the community output? So as Shannon mentioned, we have installed one of these on Minnesota, and there was definitely some mixed input that we have received from the community. Anytime you're restricting movement, there is controversy with that. It is a proven safety measure that shows that there is safety benefits to pedestrians, but it's limiting their ability to cross in those places. So it's mixed feedback you get with that. And then, of course, the aesthetics, we've received feedback on that as well. there was some dissatisfaction with the one in Minnesota. There's another slide that will be coming up with an upcoming project where we're putting in a safety fence, and we'll discuss the things that we're looking at on that one.
I think it's relevant to note that you had just mentioned in the heading here that these projects can be controversial, and it seems like that would certainly be the case with potentially some of those options. Co-Chair Eichheit?
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Co-Chair Carrick, you took my question, but I would just like to reinforce, the Minnesota Drive median fence, the so-called cheese grater. I don't have any strong opinions about personally, but I do remember a lot of consternation from some members of the community, and I think it just says how important the public process is before we build a project. And I'm not making any comment about the public process that was done before that because I'm not aware of it. I don't have that knowledge. But I did really like the idea that Representative McCabe mentioned about, a barrier along the, say, sidewalk in the street. I also have some concerns about jaywalking in Anchorage, and I've had constituents raise that, and anything to not only keep people from crossing the street in the bad places where it's not safe, but also it creates a barrier for cars who might swerve onto the sidewalk, because many of our sidewalks are right up against the street, and I know I feel vulnerable just walking by high-speed traffic by there. So thank you, Co-Chair.
Representative Mina?
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the co-chair, is the cost-benefit study, the three-year crash data for the different HSIP projects, is that publicly available?
Through the co-chair, Representative Mina, we file an annual report every year with Federal Highways. You can Google any state's 2024 HSIP annual report. They're all out there publicly. I don't believe it is project by project. That is information. If you had a specific project you were curious about, we could provide that information.
Thank you. Just follow up.
Thank
you. Through the chair, I know that the Minnesota barrier that was put up in 2024, and so we're still not at the end of the three-year period, but are we able to get any of that data as you're collecting it, or do we have to wait until after we reach the 3 years?
Through the co-chair, Representative Mina, so our last year of finished crash data is 2024. So it's not that fresh. We could get data that we have that's available. It's not certified past 2024, so whatever we have in the database from 2025, we have, but we cannot guarantee is complete. So if that was completed in 2024, we would need 24, 25, 20. We would have to wait until 2027. We would have to wait until the 2027 data was complete and certified before we'd be doing our formal analysis.
Thank you.
We have a couple more questions. Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Correct me on etiquette if I get it wrong. All right, well, we're close. On the top point, just a quick question on the goal of maximizing lives saved and serious injuries reduced per dollar spent. As you've been looking at other studies that have gone on, I recognize that the road or the lane drop versus road diet deal, we just set that aside. But as you looked at this, what is the goal? I mean, as far as, or what is the average of dollars spent versus lives saved? Or is there something that makes a project worthwhile?
Through the co-chair, Representative Nelson, we have a minimum predicted benefit cost ratio for what we call a ranked project. And this could get very technical, and I'll try to keep it at high level. We just kind of switched that up a little bit in our last handbook to sort of have a different threshold per dollar value. So the more expensive projects, we want to have a higher predicted benefit cost. And that's just making sure we're getting the best projects out there, because projects have gotten fairly expensive over time. So, you know, that 5.96 to 1, that is our sort of, you know, statistical value of a life, and what have we done, you know, what have we achieved? And I'll put out there, even a property damage crash has a crash value to it. It's just, you know, it's an exponential scale between that and a fatality. So
that answers the question. Yep.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
And Representative McCabe?
Thanks. So I've dabbled in aviation safety a little bit, and one of the things we say is the safest airplane is the one that stays on the ground, right? It seems like to me that the safest road is one where nobody travels, right? So how do you prioritize, or what do you give priority to, movement of the cars, or safety of the pedestrians? Or maybe there's a different way to look at the separation that you talked about, is separating the two, access control, I think you said to it. So I'm curious. It says the goal is maximizing lives saved and serious injuries reduced per dollar spent, right? So I get that. But do we ever consider the cost of doing that in limiting, you know, obviously on the road diet, you're going to drop the speed, right? I mean, you're going to go from 45 miles an hour to 30 miles an hour because maybe, like on Spinard Road, they did that when they put that center turn lane in, right? So do we study how much that impacts, say, commerce or people's travel or extending their days for a longer commute and those sorts of costs?
Through the co-chair, Representative McCabe, sorry about the squeaky microphone. Yes and no. I don't have a great answer for you. There are studies nationally that look at things like, there's this brochure out there called Safe Access is Good for Business, and it talks about how, you know, having reduced access points actually makes it your market area larger. So, you know, we're not economists in the safety program, so that's we really focus in on the safety piece. So when we're talking about lives saved and serious injuries reduced per dollar spent, we're saying this countermeasure has this effect on this type of crash. So we're really into the weeds with that. There are other types of studies, and our chief engineer directive sort of getting at that with that whole piece of freight and, you know, in Ingrid Gamble's and interstate and, you know, all those other sort of factors that need to weigh in somehow, but aren't as cut and dry as to how we weigh in with them.
Follow up.
And more of a comment. And I think you touched on one of the points. A lot of this is education. So I was a little bit involved with the KGB as well as the parks, four-lane, you know, just south of Big Lake Road. There was a lot of people that were really upset. Well, my customers need a turn off directly off of the parks. They don't want to go to a frontage road. And I talked to one of the business owners not too long ago who's been dealing now with a frontage road for a couple year, 18 months, however long it's been. And he's like, my business increased because now people that might not have wanted to turn off of the parks and get are on this kind of lower speed, you know, on and off access to a to his business, and especially people that, whether it be old people like me or inexperienced drivers, would not stop at his business because it was too hard to get back out into the park. So it seems to me that some education of business owners would, at least it would help us out, because we wouldn't get so many complaints about DOT limiting access to a business, right? Anyways, just comment more than anything.
Co-Chair Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Just, you know, I know part of this revolves around the tragic death of, you know, last 2 years, 30 pedestrians in Anchorage, and a death anywhere is you know, tragic. But when you talk about your cost-benefit analyses, you know, I've heard of this thing many points in my life, the statistical value, a statistical human, what someone is worth, and it seems like kind of a cold calculation. Do you know what that is currently, and is that something that is used in these analyses of cost-benefit? And yeah, it would seem like it would be, but I don't know.
to the co-chair, yes, that I don't know the number off the top of my head, and for the record, Pam Golden. We adjust that down within HSIP because it's $10, $12 million, I think, for a 10-ish for a fatality. But then you have a property damage crash and a fatality, and it tends to skew to just, you know, these the random fatalities are random. And I'm sorry, again, statistics is not always warm and fuzzy, right? So we're trying to make sure that we're capturing, you know, that whole class of, we look at property damage, a possible injury, minor injury, serious injury or major injury, and fatality. And so we kind of squish the scale within HSIP to make sure we're not chasing one hot spot. And so I don't know the numbers, but that is exactly what we start with.
Thank you.
Seeing no additional questions here, we can keep going.
For the record, Alex Reed. So the next... for the next slides, we're looking at the projects on Inger Street and Gamble Streets and the safety improvements we're making there. We have two active projects now. They have both gone through our 75% design milestone. The first project is the Inger and Gamble Street overhead signal indication upgrades. At between 5th and 3rd, we're looking at eight different signal poles, four on Inger and four on Gamble, where we're adding signal heads. A lot of those intersections only have two signal heads now. It'll be four signal heads, one over each lane. That also includes a reflective backplate. The safety measure is shown to reduce angled crashes by about 23%. And the other project is Gamble Street utility pole removal and an increased lighting. These pictures are a pretty good demonstration of what we're looking at. The existing utility poles right now are in the middle of the sidewalk toward the traffic lane. We're looking at undergrounding those utilities and increasing the lighting. Right now, our lighting is just off of those signal poles where they happen to be. We would actually be designing proper spacing and lighting for that corridor section. Both these projects we have in the HSSP plan for this fiscal year. The signal indication upgrades, there's a good chance we'll be able to get that one done as quickly as possible and get that one this year. The other project with the pole removal and increased lighting is going to be a challenge. There is 50 temporary construction easements with that project. We're doing what we can to expedite it as quickly as possible, though. Our consultant that we have on board has just brought on staff from another state so that we're not slowing down other projects and we can prioritize and move forward with that project as quick as possible without impacting other parts of the program. And then we are also using an incentive program, or we're looking at using an incentive program for those right-of-way impacts. What that does is it financially incentivizes the property owners to sign within 90 days when an offer is made. Realistically, we're going to move as fast as possible, but there's a good chance that those will be next year. And then the next project I'm going to talk about is the Fifth Avenue Concrete Street to Carlux Street pedestrian improvements. There's two major elements to this one. There is a safety fence, as we were talking about before. The safety fence is 6 feet tall. It's a barrier with a glare screen on the top. A glare screen prevents the lights from traffic on one side of the road from glaring into the opposing traffic. We are going to go through a public process to get input from the public on and stakeholders on what they want this fence to look like. There's a lot of different options we can consider. We're potentially looking at designs in that the barrier, colored concrete. As Shannon mentioned before, though, whatever we do is that barrier has to be crash rated. It is right adjacent to the traffic, and that does limit what we can do. But we'll be exploring different options and working with the public to find what the best solution is there. As I mentioned before, this is a proven safety measure. Studies show about an 86% reduction in crashes with pedestrians that are crossing mid-block. And then the other part of the project is lighting. There's a large gap in lighting right now. That's due to Merrill Field. We are currently working with Merrill Field. We actually just met with them a couple days ago to figure out the best placement of those lights and what we can do with the lighting to help improve that as well.
And I have a question here. I am wondering if this was the... So we had just talked about the pedestrian fencing a little bit earlier, and also earlier in the presentation about how a lot of improvements you want to see some up to 3-year data just for how well that's working. So help me understand, how long have we had, not that it's directly informing this project, but how long have we had the Minnesota pedestrian fencing barriers, and does that information inform at all this project?
Co-Chair Carrick, that one was constructed in 2024. So we only have about a year's worth of data for that. So we haven't started to analyze that. It kind of goes back to the same question that Representative Mina asked earlier. We are using studies and statistics from other states and other studies right now. So it is still based off of actual data. As far as data that we have in Anchorage, it's still too early to have solidified data from that Minnesota project.
And as a follow-up, are there other pedestrian safety measures being taken in this particular area?
Right now with this project, it's just the increased lighting and the safety fence.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Mina?
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the co-chairs, I'm happy to hear that there will be engagement with the local communities on this project, because I feel like my communities will definitely have some feedback on this area. I'm curious, with the different types of pedestrian safety improvements that you have, how is this barrier being prioritized versus other types of improvements, pedestrian safety improvements?
Through the co-chair, Rep. Mina, may I ask a follow-up are you referring to specifically at this location or Anchorage?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. That helps.
Yeah.
You know, specific to this location, again, this was a project nominated, you know, probably a couple years ago at this point. You know, what's interesting is there's not a lot of, you know, Merrill Field has fence up along their facility, and there are not a lot of origins, destinations, one side from the other. This goes back to what Representative McCabe was saying, that sometimes blocking access might be your quickest solution. And I'm super paraphrasing him. I apologize for that. But this is one of those, you know, when we're looking at what can we do quickly, what can we do that saves these lives the fastest, or the reduces these injuries, this is potentially an interim solution. There is the Seward Glen, all that work and studies being going on that might potentially take the traffic off of this road in the future. This is one of those perfect examples of this could be the interim solution that gets us that, you know, 5-10 years that we need until something different happens with this road.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, feel free to continue.
So we wanted to highlight a couple of things that are going around the state, because, of course, HSIP is a statewide program. And there's something that's actually I'm very excited about. There's a smart pedestrian lighting pilot that's going into Kodiak actually next week. It will be installed on a singular crosswalk, and it's right on Rezanov Drive near Cope Street. And what this is, it's a dynamic lighting system, so it detects when there is a pedestrian in the crosswalk and lights the crosswalk, much like you see in the photograph. It lights the crosswalk while the pedestrian crosses, and this provides some conspicuity for the driver to see the pedestrian, and of course the pedestrian that light to cross as well. So we're excited about to install this. We're excited to study it and see how it works. Obviously, this is an area that there's actually a lot of pedestrian crossing. It's right near a hotel, but there's, in terms of AADT, annual average daily traffic, it isn't very high. So it could be a great place to study. And then if we are successful, we could bring it to other communities as well.
I didn't think we would get off this Kodiak slide without a question from Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question. I hope you're doing something to educate the people in Kodiak that this is going to be there, because I know that we had a stoplight in Kodiak, and after 50 years or something, they finally fixed it. And for the next year, nobody stopped at it because they weren't used to it working. And so I can foresee this same thing in a small community like that. People are like, you know, a rat in a maze, and they're used to going one way. And unless you educate them or inform them that this is coming, it might not be as successful as you hope it will be.
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, we agree completely, and we're actually sending a public information officer from South Coast to go to the installation to get footage so that we can create materials to educate the public.
Follow-up. Wonderful. Thank you.
So to continue on this slide, I also wanted to point out that we do have a region-wide guardrail inventory and upgrades. This is a modernization project. There are two areas in Kodiak that we are going to be replacing guardrail. One is just a very short section, basically from 1.5 mile to 1.6, and then a larger section from about mile post 4 to mile post 10. And guardrail modernizations, we have been trying to get them done all over the state. We are targeting roads over 40 miles an hour because, as we know, slower speed crashes have less severe outcomes. Guardrail is, while it is a mitigation feature, it's not a safety feature, and we probably could go in to talk about that for the next hour, but when a vehicle crashes into a guardrail at 40 miles an hour, it is an obstacle in the right of way. So we want to make sure that we have the most modern guardrail possible on those higher speed roads. And then I also wanted to mention that it coming soon is the Chiniac Highway Rehabilitation Project. That's milepost 15 to 31, and that also includes guardrail replacement.
Oh, sorry. Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Appreciate it. This is good news. I was told 3 years ago that all of our recalled guardrails in Kodiak were going to be replaced, of which none of them have. I'm hoping that in the very near future that these guardrails that have been recalled and have been recalled because they're deemed to be dangerous are replaced. Might that be the case?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes. So guardrail is an incredibly complicated subject, and part of what happened is that they didn't actually recall the old guardrail. So what they did instead is they passed new standards, and they said that that the guardrail can stay in place until that is modernized. And so that's what these projects are aiming to do, is to identify that old guardrail and get it replaced. And I think what might be appropriate, if I can offer it to you, is that we probably should sit down and talk about where the old guardrail is and what our plan is to replace that with you, because I know that that's been an interest for quite some time.
Thank you kindly.
I appreciate it. So I'm going to jump into this one, although I think Pam is actually the expert. This is a highlight from the Fairbanks area, and this is actually, for me, also an exciting project. For those of you that have driven around Fairbanks for a number of years, you know that Sheep Creek Parks Highway intersection many years ago started off as an angled intersection so that people could, you know, zoom right onto the Parks Highway, not come to a complete stop. So there's been a number of improvements over the years. Back in, I believe, both 2008 and then 2011, we had interim steps to make that safer. This project, though, it's a continuous green T. So I'm looking at Pam because she's an expert on this one. But it provides some additional safety for the Parks Highway. But what we really found was that the crashes really were coming from the drivers that were coming off Sheep Creek. So it controls their access in terms of it allows them, or it gets them to a signal. But then also for vulnerable road users, it actually It provides a protected crossing for both bicyclists and pedestrians, so they can get across this intersection safely and connect with the trail on the same side of the road.
And of course, we can't get off this one without me asking two questions here. I drive this probably 6 times a day, so I'm super, super familiar with this intersection. Two questions. One is the kind of westbound sidewalk traffic. The sidewalk currently abruptly ends at the corner and does not continue down Sheep Creek Extension to hook up with the bike path onto the university campus. Is there any plan to have a bike path there as opposed to the current shoulder use that we see?
For the record, Pam Golden, to the co-chair, I know our designer for this project has been working with Fast Planning to figure out how they might find some funding for that. It does not fit into this project.
And I would just say that is such an important priority for increasing pedestrian safety at this intersection, for one thing. And then the second question is, the standard practice for drivers, whether it's correct or not, is there's a lot of folks that get off on onto Geist, like within a half a mile of getting onto the Parks Highway. And so the standard practice when turning onto the Parks Highway is to pull all the way into the far lane, which is not what you're supposed to do, or to immediately change lanes. And I'm seeing a barrier between lanes 2 and 1. So how does that barrier extend very far, or will it be, and how high is that barrier? So in other words, how easy is it going to be for traffic to transfer over to be prepared to immediately exit back off the parks?
To the co-chair. So if you're familiar with what the striping looks like now, that solid white line that we added in 2011, 2012, that's about where it's a curved median. It's something, because of the speed of the road, it has to be something that is traversable. You should not traverse it, but it has to be traversable. So it's fairly similar to what's there now, only it's adding a signal to the mix. There is still plenty of room beyond the end of that raised median to safely, merge over and get off at Geist. Also a regular user of the intersection, so we've seen it all there. So, what's a continuous green T, for those who aren't familiar, northbound parks traffic, sorry, it's technically eastbound here, but it's highway northbound. Fairbanks bound traffic will never have to stop. It's just the turning traffic that has to stop. And that same treatment is coming here next summer to Vanderbilt Hill and Egan. So that traffic coming in from the valley will have that same thing. Also an HSIP project, but I just wanted to highlight that it will be in 2 locations across the state, this type of intersection.
Oh, so you're saying here in Juneau that the exit off of the highway out to the valley onto Mendenhall Loop Road?
To the co-chair, Vanderbilt.
Vanderbilt is closer to downtown.
To the co-chair, yes. I think of it as the road you have to take to get to Home Depot.
Okay. We might want to meet offline just about this intersection. I'm actually very excited about this project. It is a problem, but just want to understand it a little bit better. Same with, I think, a recurring theme with this whole presentation today. But thank you.
For the record, Alex Reed. I'm going to go through some safety projects that we have in the Matsu Borough. The first 3 projects listed are all intersection improvement projects. They are also all single lane roundabouts that we're recommending. Single lane roundabouts compared to signalized intersections have about 90% reduction in in fatalities, a 76% reduction in injuries, and a 35% reduction in overall crashes. The first project is the image you actually see on there. It's a good representation of what the downside of a roundabout is. While it is generally safer than a signalized intersection, it takes more space. The green hatched area shows the area that we need for the project. So they tend to have right-of-way impacts. The first project, Bogarda-Ingstrom Road and Green Forest Drive intersection, it's kind of an interesting problem where the existing roadways, Forest Drive and Ingstrom, don't quite line up. They're about 200 feet apart. This project would be lining those up and putting them at the roundabout. Right now, we are going through some right-of-way acquisitions that are proving a little bit challenging. Our goal is to get this one obligated this fiscal year. It's possible we'll see construction late this year, but in reality, the bulk of it would probably start next year. The next project is Vine Road at Hollywood Road, intersection improvements. This project, we have just started the right-of-way process. We're looking at a 2028 construction. It is grouped together with the Vine Road reconstruction project. We'll have a continuous path from Knit Goose Bay Road all the way up to the elementary school with this project and continuous lighting as well. And then the next project, Wasilla Fishhook Road and Spruce Avenue Peck Street Roundabout. That's in a pretty similar spot where we're finishing up the design. We still have some right-of-way we need to get. We're hoping to obligate this year. The bulk of the construction will likely be next year, maybe the end of this year. Next project's Pittman Road, shoulder widening and slope flattening. That one goes from Zander Road to Church Road, so it's about 6.5 miles. That section of Pittman has 0 to 2 feet shoulders throughout it and very steep slopes. This project is widening the shoulders to 6 feet and flattening some of those slopes to make them recoverable. And that one's looking at a 2028 construction. We are working to reduce the right-of-way impacts as much as possible, which may mean not flattening the slopes as much as we'd like. And then the last two projects are actually grouped together with a CTP project. So it's all one sort of a Frankenstein-type project that actually goes from Trunk Road to Ingstrom. So about 4 miles, and in that project, we're looking at adding pedestrian pathway, doing drainage improvements, adding turn lanes. We're looking at different options for a two-way left turn lane versus median left turn lanes, some intersection treatments within that section as well. And that one, we're currently looking at a 2032 construction date. With the widening of that road, there are in right-of-way impacts throughout. We're potentially considering also phasing that to get one phase out to get some improvements sooner rather than later.
Representative McCabe, far be it from us to leave the Matt Sue slide without some
right.
input here.
There you go. Perfect. So one of my pet peeves is the Main Street KGB intersection versus the railroad, frankly. It seems to me there's been an inordinate number of crashes there. There is no real turn lane to get from the parks southbound onto KGB, and so they end up in the shoulder, especially when the train is there. Sometimes they end up in the shoulder all the way back to Lucille or even further back. And so you have a line of 60, 70 cars that are on the shoulder, but not quite on the shoulder because it's not very wide. And I suspect it all has to do with the railroad right-of-way. And I'm wondering if there's not a way to access the at-grade crossing safety funds that the Federal Railroad Administration has and see if we can't put a barrier up and create a turn lane or storage lane, if you will, for those cars for when the train is there and backing up traffic.
For the record, Pam Golden, through the co-chair, Representative McCabe, the Section 130 funds that you're talking about, it's like less than $2 million a year. So it probably doesn't scratch that. I just wanted to put that out there. We can definitely initiate some conversations with the railroad. I believe that is now in the boundaries of MVP's MPO. Is that He's
yes.
nodding yes. Okay.
Yeah.
And so sometimes just being within the MPOs helps us facilitate those conversations with the railroad a little better. So it's definitely something we can take back and have some further discussion about, you know, what that might take to do something there.
And I know there's Wasilla's going to make a one-way, one of them's going to be one-way, and they're going to make another road the other direction and make some one-way traffic. But I think that turning from onto KGB from the park southbound is still going to be an issue unless we accomplish something at the same time as they do the one-way thing, maybe. And just, I mean, even if it, even if there was a turn lane there, an extended turn lane, or some way of protecting those cars that right now they're kind of half in and half out of traffic. And anyways, pet peeve of mine. So I would encourage you to look at it.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, improvements to that intersection are part of the Main Street project. So that is already included with Main Street.
Good. Thanks.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Is in the MATSU, the work that's happening right now on Palmer Fish Hook to Trunk, where there's the gas station, does that fall under this same program? There's a lot of work going on.
Correct. That is an HSIP project.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, we can continue.
So I just wanted, this is Shannon McCarthy for the record. I just wanted to highlight some of the exciting things that are happening across Alaska, some big, some small. One of the things that we were able to accomplish in 2025 was that we found one-time funding, and we bought extrication equipment for 14 different volunteer fire and rescue departments across Alaska. About a week and a half ago, these have been delivered, and about a week and a half ago, Deltana reported that they used it for the first time. Well, the crash was not fortunate. The fact that they had the equipment was, the people were uninjured, but they were trapped in their car. So they were able to get in there and get people extricated and their dog. And we were really excited that that we had gotten them the equipment in time, and they had trained on it, so they were able to use it. Another thing that we've been doing in 2025 is for the first time we've been distributing reflective gear. We started off with the Tanana Valley State Fair, providing reflective gear to fairgoers. We went on to the Palmer Fair. We also partnered with the Anchorage Coalition to End Homelessness. We went to their Connect event and provided about 400 people with reflective gear. We've also partnered with the Municipality of Anchorage Transit Center, so gave them a couple boxes of gear so that they can distribute that to their patrons, because we know that those folks are walking to bus stops and from bus stops. So that's exactly the folks that we want to have reflective gear at their fingertips. And then we've also distributed at some community councils and through a couple legislative offices. So we'd like to continue this effort into 2026 and kind of change the culture of Anchorage in that if you're going to go for a walk, we just want you to throw on something that has a reflective element to it. Another thing that it was actually through an idea that came up through the Vision Zero Task Force, and that and actually Pam could address this, but we now have quick release funds, and this is the intersection of C Street and Benson was an area of two fatalities. The team of this group of people were able to look at it, and we're going to make some changes to the intersection so that there are fewer conflicts with pedestrians that are crossing and cars that are turning. To go on Egan Drive, many of you have probably traveled already this session down to the Fred Meyer area. This actually has a seasonal speed reduction, and that seems to be working. We can pull the numbers on that if you're interested. And then a couple things. We're doing these safety audits. Pam referred to them earlier. We were able to do the field work on Geist Road and College Road up in Fairbanks this last summer, and then they're doing the analyzation this winter. The ones that are starting in Anchorage this year are Muldoon from 36 to Glen and from Tudor Minnesota Drive to Kingston Drive. And this is where we bring people from outside of the community so they can look at an intersection or a section of road with fresh eyes and give recommendations based on that. And then also, we did a full pedestrian and work zone outreach. We started work zone in August because we have a demonstrated crash history of Alaskans crashing in work zones in August. It seems a little unusual. We thought we would have seen them crashing more in kind of May when work zones are new. It's not the case. And then we also obviously have a pedestrian crash problem in all of our cities in September and September and October. There we go. September and October. So we actually produced several ads that addressed behaviors that we know are connected with crashes. many of them driver behaviors, a couple of them pedestrian behaviors. So we tried that for the first time. We felt it was actually received fairly positively by the public, and we're going to be expanding that effort in the coming year. And then, of course, seatbelt outreach campaigns we're adding to the mix. And then also in 2025, we put up a crash data dashboard, rather, that you can look at. It is at public.alaskadata.net, and you can look at the last 5 years of crash data in our cities. Oh, and I forgot. Yes, thank you, Pam. We also have a community request to reduce the speed from 45 to 35 on Tudor and Muldoon roads. We're conducting a hearing on that in the first quarter of 2006, and that's per our speed policy. So lots of things that are happening. Some of them, like I said, you know, fairly low cost. But if there's any questions on that, I can pause.
Well, we have a couple questions. Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you thought about putting anything like cameras up or anything? I have been to Anchorage, and I have never, ever, and I'm not a spring chicken, been in a community where as many people run yellow and red lights as I have in Anchorage. I mean, it was unbelievable. You start to slow down because the light turns yellow, and the guy behind you goes around you and runs through the red light. And I look at all these pedestrian, I mean, even if they're fake cameras, you would think that it would be some sort of deterrent for these people when the light turns yellow to start to slow down.
For the record, Pam Golden, through the chair, Representative Stutes. So there are actually a couple of projects in Anchorage to address some of this. There are some camera projects, so not all of the intersections have the pan tilt zoom cameras. It looks like a bubble basically sitting up there, and so that is getting that infrastructure out there so that APD has access to that. Mostly they're looking at that for sort of like dealing with hit and run and how they respond to that, but then there is that availability to collect data about that sort of thing. They're one of the newer signal projects is also for what's called a red light indicator program, and so that's just a light that sits on top of the traffic signal that it goes on basically when the light turns red. So you don't need two officers to have one confirm that the light was red. One officer can confirm that the light was red. So if they do see a red light runner, they have that ability with that confirmation, because right now it's a two officer issue.
And Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, I love hearing about the work being done related to distributing reflective gear. Love the crash data. I think that's awesome for transparency and just helping the public know where our hotspots are. Could you tell me more about that C Street and Benson Boulevard improvement? Because, you know, it's, you know, a tragedy that there was a fatality there. I think there's been a few. I just would love to learn more.
Yeah. Through the Co-Chair, Representative Mina. So at that location, if you're southbound on C and you want to turn left on Benson, right now it is a through left and I believe two or three throughs. There's a lot going on there, because it's a pair of one-way streets, the pedestrian has a green or a white walk person at the same time the left turns have their left turning movement. And so what we're going to do with that rapid response money is make it so that conflict doesn't exist anymore. And so we'll have to convert the signal heads to turn arrows. And then we're going to implement what's called a leading pedestrian interval there. So this will be, I believe, the first in Anchorage. I'm not 100% confident on that, but the pedestrian will get it's 3 to 7 seconds. It depends on how the timing works out. Head start. If we go that way, but we really want to make sure that the pedestrian is not given the same green, if you will, as the car, so that we're not putting two people in the same space potentially at the same time. So it's really sort of taking that conflict and removing it. It will introduce a little delay into the signal, but which then has to be coordinated. We would have gone faster, but that is one of the oldest signal controllers in the entire state. So we had to get a controller cabinet that fits on that foundation that's out there. So it was pretty old stuff.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. And through my co-chair, Just mostly a comment. So if I heard you correctly, there's going to be a public hearing on reducing a speed limit on one of the state roads in Anchorage. And I'm very pleased to hear that because, you know, first of all, I believe in the public process. You know, there's a lot of unintended consequences unless you ask folks on the ground. And the other is, you know, I did do a little research. You know, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which is part of DOT, cited six studies in their opening page on whether, you know, essentially does higher speed create safety issues. And it's pretty clear that slower speeds do result in a reduction of property damage and reduction of number of accidents as well as injuries because you have faster you go, less reaction time. And faster you go, the higher the impact forces. So I'm very pleased that you're having that because I understand the lane reductions take some time. That made a lot of sense to me. But this is something, reducing speeds is something a community and a state can do to address those hot spots where warranted. So just want to thank you for that.
And Representative McCabe.
Thanks. And yet I've waited almost 18 months now for speed reductions on the Talkeetna Spur, on the Trapper Creek Spur. I know there's a road in Homer that's been waiting about 3 years now for the study for speed reductions. So I'm curious. Maybe you guys would be better at doing that than wherever they're, whoever's working on it right now. The community council, so the public input, community councils in Trapper Creek as well as Talkeetna and Upper Susitna have clearly requested that we lower the speed limit 10 miles an hour within a mile on either side, I think. I know you guys had a sign out there by Trapper Creek at one point, the flashing your speed is. Because folks go cooking through there pretty fast, and you know, since we don't have a Talkeetna trooper post, there's not much enforcement up there, and everybody knows it. So the mix of the kids coming out of the Talkeetna High School, which is right there, and the 18-wheelers or doubles coming up there at 60 miles an hour, 65, slowing down to 55, right there by the spur, I get it, but they need to go slower, I think. It's a recipe there for an issue, and so anyways, hopefully you can work on that for us, maybe, please.
Through the co-chair to Representative McCabe, noted.
I think we have just a couple slides left, so maybe we'll go through those and see what questions remain.
For the record, Shannon McCarthy, DOT. This is a bit of a sobering slide, but we wanted to share it. These are our top five fatal and injury crash locations. As we know, oftentimes an urban density of people is associated with higher crash rates. And so that's what we see here is Anchorage, the Mat-Su, Fairbanks, Kenai Peninsula Borough, Juneau. And you can see that they... in terms of a percentage of Alaska population, there's a correlation of the total fatal and serious injured crashes. So you can see Anchorage is, just below 40% of the population and, 35%. So it's kind of, it correlates 35% of the total fatal and serious injured crashes. But as you move over, you can see that vulnerable road users, so pedestrians, bikers, anyone who rolls, they are overrepresented in those fatality and serious injury statistics. Another thing I wanted to point out, which caught our attention when we were putting this presentation together, was the Kenai Borough. They have 8% of the population, but they have 15% of the fatal and serious injury crashes. So something that I know Pam's team will be looking at in the coming future. We do have a mistake on the slide. On the last row, all the way to the bottom on the right, it should say 14.4%, not 84%. Someone was just, I think, maybe not paying attention. So we'll get that corrected and provide the new copy to the committee. All right, so seeing no questions on that last slide, we wanted to end with this. This is actually something that's we've been kind of excited about every day that's been passing. But from November 22nd to January 21st, which was yesterday, we've had zero pedestrian fatalities. If you look at 2025 and 2024, we had a pedestrian fatality about every 20 days. And so we have gone 61 days. So I can show you the 2025 statistics, not positive, but we do have these pockets where pedestrian fatalities have stopped, and even with vehicle fatalities, we had a period of time from the 25th to the 21st, which was just yesterday, with zero vehicle fatalities. And so we wanted to emphasize that we know that zero is possible. It does take all of us working together. It takes safer infrastructure. It takes safer drivers, safer people.
Enforcement. Enforcement.
Education. Oh, education enforcement, exactly. So we just wanted to end in the slide that there are some positive things happening. We have a long way to go, and working together, we know that we can do a lot of good.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the chair, it's really great to see the zero pedestrian fatalities over the past few months. I do want to note that there was a bicycle fatality in Anchorage last summer.
The chair, Representative Mina, we'll get that corrected.
Thank you.
I don't see any additional questions looking around the table. Representative Nelson.
Sorry, one more. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Back to the beginning. So pardon me for going all the way back, talking about lane drops and road diets, all that stuff. But correct me if I'm wrong, that the goal, the main player for increased pedestrian safety, is essentially to narrow the space that the pedestrians have to cross. Is that accurate?
For the record, Pam Golden, through the co-chair, Representative Nelson. That is one of two pieces. Mm-hmm. So the crossing distance, of course, is one. And then what you do with the reallocated space is sort of where that other piece comes in. It could be a variety of things. It could be an increased buffer between a travel lane and a pedestrian. It could be some sort of it's creating those separate spaces.
Yep. One quick follow-up.
Sorry, let me just add a little bit to that. For the record, Alex Reed. You also see decreased speeds frequently. There's a good example, Spinard Road. The municipality has already done two projects on Spinard before and after. We saw about a 5 mile an hour reduction in speeds, not even changing the posted speed, just the average speed people were driving.
Mm-hmm. Yep, thank you. And then the follow-up, you had mentioned that you've read a plethora of crash reports, essentially. And I know that this is hard probably to quantify, but how often do people get it? Is there a way to quantify if people are getting hit as they start to cross the traffic versus when they get to the end of the lane? You know what I'm saying? The other side.
For the record, Pam Golden, through the co-chair, Representative Nelson, plethora is also one of my favorite words, so thank you for that. We've read a lot of crash narratives, and crash narratives are something that we're getting with the law enforcement officer who was there. And I will tell you, it is all over the place. It is people beginning to cross. It is people waiting on the curb. It is people crossing when they shouldn't cross, and they have the red hand. The car has the green light. At signals, then the mid block is everybody you wait for so long, and then we all have that little bit of like. Higher level of risk we're willing to take the longer we're waiting. So there's the peekaboo problem, and I describe that we the Vision Zero Task Force, we got to see a video that was available from one of the signal cameras where the first car stopped. Second car didn't know why the first car stopped, went around and hit the pedestrian who was crossing mid-block. It is everything, and that's why we go back to it's a safe system. It's the driver. It's also the person, the vulnerable user. It's the whole safety network of things out there.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Eichheit.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. And through the co-chair, just two comments. One on the bicycle fatality. It was last June on C Street.
Thank you.
There was an impaired driver struck a bicyclist who died on the scene. And then I did want to mention a follow-up to Representative Stute's accurate assertion about red light running in Anchorage. So Yes, I've noticed that whenever we have guests from outside, we say when you rent your car and you're driving through Anchorage, when you come to a red light, when it turns green, look both ways and just be super careful. But I did have a chance to tour the Anchorage Police Department's real-time crime center in December. And what they do is they tie into those traffic intersection cameras, not for enforcement, but to do follow-up investigations. So if a red light runner were to have a crash, it's a follow-up. It's also used when there is, say, somebody's identified in the community as doing something bad. And they can actually use those cameras to see where they are on public streets and direct APD personnel to those sites. So real-time crime center, it's not used for active enforcement, but it is used to assist enforcement and follow-up investigations, and I was quite impressed to see what they do.
And I just have a question as well. I kind of want to go back to the very first slide that we had here. So I know the updated 2026 Anchorage funding is $30 million. What was it anticipated to be previously before this most recent decision?
For the record, Pam Golden to the co-chair, it was in the neighborhood of 9 to 10. Okay. I don't know the exact number, but it was in that neighborhood.
And just as a follow-up, is the difference in those funds through advanced construction, is that how we're getting between 9 and 30 million?
To the co-chair, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Meaton.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the co-chair, I just have some thoughts. Thinking through the pedestrian barrier on 15th. So I'm primarily a pedestrian. I don't have a car in Juneau. I really drive in Anchorage. I usually bike around in the summer. I've been biking around on 15th. I use the bus stops, and I walk over in Minnesota. So I've experienced all those different roads and those sidewalks. And part of what makes those pedestrian barriers uncomfortable for me is, as a pedestrian, I do like being seen. I have my little reflector on my bag right now, and what I wouldn't want is for people to drive faster on 15th and to treat it like a highway. And so my first ask is, I would love to see that Minnesota crash data, because I appreciate that the HSIP projects are data-driven, and I'm a little skeptical about whether these pedestrian barriers do reduce crashes. So I want to see what that data is so far. My second worry is that we're going to experience a repeat of what happened with that Minnesota barrier, where there was a big community backlash. And I know you're restricted because of the process where you have a cart before the horse situation, and you have to do the public input after. And so I'll do my part to share about this project with my district and my community councils, because I know they'll have opinions. But I'm wondering if DOT is exploring other ways to better engage with the public on the HSIP projects, so we don't have the situation where the public feels that DOT is pushing projects on them that they don't want.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Meaton, I agree with you completely. Something that I've worked with traffic and safety on for a number of years is the HSIP just does not have the same level of its engagement as other projects. So, and many of our projects may have a public involvement specialist with the design group that they've hired, the consultant. So, in many times, I've acted as the PI professional for the specific projects, and we will continue doing that, and we will up our game on that, because I do think that HSAP is such a critical component. There's a lot of education that really needs to go with it to make it effective, and so it's certainly, I know that working with Pam and her team has been really valuable for me in terms of, I tell Pam this all the time, that
that that traffic engineering is so different than just regular engineering because there's a lot of human behavior involved. So you need to take that into account. And that includes ensuring that we're engaging with the public, explaining what we're doing, talking about different options. Because there are some options available to us. You know, for example, the pedestrian fencing, that imprinted concrete looks so much better than just a jersey barrier. So there's some options, and we've made that commitment to Anchorage that we would engage on aesthetics and talk about what we were doing, and we're committed to that.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you so much. I also just wanted to acknowledge this whole hearing, I think, but I just noticed it. We did have Lauren Little from DOT's chief engineer in Fairbanks. That was online for questions. I want to just thank Lauren for being available for questions too. But thank you very much, Ms. McCarthy, Ms. Golden, Mr. Reed. It's really informative to get to have this conversation with you. Our next House Transportation meeting is on Tuesday, January 27th at 1 p.m. here in room 124. At that hearing, we are going to be hearing from the commissioner and some staff on the $70 million in supplemental funding that the legislature needs to provide to ensure we capture all available federal funds. Next Thursday, we are a little bit flexible on schedule right now, but we anticipate covering winter road maintenance generally and potentially a first bill hearing on Representative Holland's Whittier transfer bill. So that's what's on the agenda for next week. And with nothing else coming before the committee, we are adjourned at 2:47.